Blog Talk Radio. Greetings. This is Abayomi Azikwe. Welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Today is Sunday, August 31st, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to this special edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And today we're broadcasting once again in conjunction with the Detroit International Jazz Festival, which we covered yesterday. Yesterday, there were performances by numerous outstanding artists, including Barry Harris with his trio. There was, of course, Pharoah Sanders and Lou Donaldson's organ quartet, also a performance by Randy Weston's African Rhythms, outstanding jazz artists here in the city of Detroit for the 35th annual Detroit International Jazz Festival. And today there will be more. We will also be attending and covering today's jazz festival as well. And there's going to be a performance with Billy Harper and Randy Weston, a duo. And, of course, we will be on hand to cover that, as well as other highlights of the festival, including upcoming performances by the Rooney Orchestra. And, of course, there will also be performances by both Wayne Shorter and Ron Carter, a tribute to Miles Davis. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And today is Sunday, August 31st, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And we were just speaking about the phenomenal music of jazz, which is being featured and highlighted this week in the city of Detroit and downtown. And we'd like to play some music from the legendary Billie Holiday.
My days have grown so lonely. For you I cry. Thank you. unless there's magic, the end will be tragic. An echo or tale that's been told so often, my life revolves about you. What earthly good am I without you? I tell you, I mean it. I'm all for you, body and soul.
And welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Bayomi Ezekwe. And we just heard the sound of Billie Holiday with the tune entitled Body and Soul. And later on today, we'll be covering the Detroit International Jazz Festival. So we'll be back at a later date with more music related to the history and legacy of jazz music here in the United States. And right now, we're going to listen to the sound of John Coltrane along with Duke Ellington and My Little Brown Book.
Thank you.
the music of Duke Ellington and John Coltrane with the tune entitled My Little Brown Book. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And we're broadcasting today, Sunday, August 31st, 2014, live from our studios in downtown Detroit. And this weekend, which is Labor Day weekend in the United States, the Detroit International Jazz Festival is conducting its 35th annual gathering of some of the most talented and outstanding jazz musicians in the world. And we are dedicating this program to the 35th anniversary of the Detroit International Jazz Festival. A little bit later on in our program, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. And we'll be bringing you some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. This is Abayomi Azikwe. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. Thank you. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Azikwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. Today is Sunday, August 31st, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. And we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Thank you. Thank you.
And welcome back. This is Abayomi Azikwe. You're listening to the sound of the Pan-African Journal. We just heard John Coltrane from the album Giant Steps and Naima. And this weekend in downtown Detroit, where we're broadcasting from, there is the 35th annual Detroit International Jazz Festival. We've been covering that festival over the last 2 days. Today is the third day. There's going to be numerous artists performing, including Dave Holland, Eric Harlan. There's going to be a tribute to Miles Davis by Wallace Rooney and Orchestra, featuring Wayne Shorter's Universe. Later, there will be Regina Carter, who will be performing a tribute to Nat King Cole, featuring Ramsey Lewis and John Pazzarelli. Performance in honor of Louis Armstrong takes place this afternoon at 3:45 p.m., featuring Marcus Belgrave, Nicholas Payton, and Wendell Brunias. Randy Weston, whose African Rhythms performed last evening to the rapturous applause of the audience, will perform again today along with Billy Harper in a duo entitled The Roots of Blues. Al Foster's quartet will also be there tonight as well. And this will be continuing into tomorrow. This festival is held annually. This is the 35th year during the Labor Day weekend here in the city of Detroit. And we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Azikwe, and we just heard the sound of John Coltrane, and we are honoring the 35th anniversary of the Detroit International Jazz Festival that's taking place this weekend. Today is the third day. Tomorrow will be the fourth and concluding day. And this is the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe, and today we're broadcasting live on Sunday, August 31st, 2014, from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. Right now, we'd like to bring you our regular Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in this week's Pan-African Newswire, we'll be dealing with the ongoing political and security situation inside the Southern African state of Lesotho. Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane accused Deputy Prime Minister Mohioa Metsing of helping to plan a coup by the army that forced the prime minister to flee the country. Metsing took charge of the government once Thabane had fled the country for neighboring South Africa. Thabane left on Saturday, yesterday, August the 30th, after the army surrounded his residence and police stations in Lesotho's capital of Maseru. Gunshots were heard in Maseru, where one policeman was shot dead and four others wounded, said Senior Police Superintendent Mafokeng Kolo. But the army denied trying to force out Thabane, saying it had moved against police suspected of planning to arm a political faction in the small Southern African kingdom. Diplomats in Maseru told Reuters press agency the army was largely seen as loyal to the deputy prime minister, and the police force mostly supported the prime minister. Regional power South Africa condemned the army's actions and invited the deputy prime minister to talks there on Sunday, today, August the 31st. Lesotho's Minister of Communications, Science and Technology, Salibe Mochoporani, told Reuters press agency he did not specify who the talks would be with. Quote, constitutionally, in the absence of the prime minister, the deputy prime minister takes the reins, unquote, said Mochoporani, who is also spokesman for Metsing's party. Quote, for now, there hasn't been any arrangement, but it goes without saying the deputy prime minister will still oversee other issues that need to be taken care of until the prime minister returns, unquote, he added. On Saturday, Mochoporani echoed the army's assurance that no coup had taken place. The prime minister, who expected to be back in Maseru in 2 days' time, said he believed his deputy was behind the plans for a coup. The two would not be holding talks in South Africa, he said. Quote, I have no such reason to absolve him from the blame, unquote, Thabane told Reuters press agency. Quote, looking from a distance, he is very active in this show, unquote. Relations have been stormy between Thabane's All Basotho Convention Party and Metsing's Lesotho Congress for Democracy, the LCD group, which formed a coalition with another party at the elections of 2012. Thabane dissolved parliament in June to avoid a no-confidence vote against him amid feuding among the ruling parties. Metsing later said he would form a new coalition that would oust Thabane. The African Union said on Sunday it would not tolerate any illegal seizure of power. Thabane told Reuters on Saturday, August the 30th, he had fired an army commander, Lieutenant General Kennedy Kladi Kamodi, and appointed Brigadier Mao Paranoi Mahau to replace him. But on Sunday, Kamodi said he was still in charge of the military. Quote, I haven't gotten any formal letter from anybody that is to say that I am still the commander of the Lesotho Defense Forces, unquote, Kamodi told Reuters. Lesotho, a mountainous state of 2 million people encircled by the Republic of South Africa, has undergone a number of military coups since its independence in 1966. At least 58 locals and 8 South African soldiers died during a political standoff and subsequent military clashes in 1998. when the South African National Defense Forces and the Botswana Defense Forces intervened to put down an attempted military coup. Besides textile exports and a slice of regional customs receipts, Lesotho's other big earner is hydroelectric power. The power is exported to South Africa from the massive mountain ranges that have made it a favorite of trivia fans as the, quote, world's highest country, unquote. Its lowest point is 1,380 meters, 4,528 feet above sea level. And also additional news from the southern African state of Lesotho. Lesotho's prime minister is in South Africa to meet with leaders of his country's coalition government and South Africa's president to discuss recent unrest in the mountainous kingdom. This is according to an official of the Lesotho government. Prime Minister Thomas Tabani has said he fled to South Africa after an alleged attempt by the military to take over the country of about 2 million people. Lesotho's defense ministry and the defense forces deny any attempt at a coup, although they say the military exchanged gunfire and disarmed two police stations in Lesotho's capital, Maseru, on Saturday, August the 30th. Lesotho's deputy prime minister, Motoyoa Metsing, is running the government while Tabani is out of the country, according to the Constitution, said Foreign Affairs Minister Mulabi Kenneth Sekoa. Political tensions have been high between the two and within the coalition government in the tiny kingdom since June, when Tabani suspended parliament to dodge a vote of no confidence. Tabani's All Basotho Convention Party and Metsing's Lesotho Congress for Democracy formed a coalition with a third party after the 2012 elections, and since then, conflict has been simmering. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma and Namibia's president are meeting with Lesotho's coalition leaders, including Metsing, on Sunday to discuss the unrest and to work towards resolution, said Sekoa. The countries are a part of the 15-nation regional group, the Southern African Development Community, which has taken action to resolve conflict in Lesotho during the last several decades. There was little evidence of the conflict Sunday in Maseru, where people went about their daily lives. Lesotho's Defense Forces spokesman, Kledi Ntoye, said the military had gathered intelligence that the police were going to arm factions participating in a demonstration planned for Monday by one of the coalition parties, the Lesotho Congress for Democracy. The military disarmed police in the capital of Maseru to avoid bloodshed, Ntoye said. An exchange of gunfire between the military, youth, and police injured one soldier and four policemen, Ntoye said. Radio stations were also off the air for hours on Saturday. Quote, the arms have been removed and they are in a military custody. The police has returned to the barracks, unquote, Ntoye said, denying reports of any coup attempt. Quote, we are not in a position now or in the future to stage a coup. All we do is to carry out our mandate to secure our country and property, unquote. The Lesotho's prime minister told South Africa's ENCA television that the military actions amounted to a coup. He said he did not give permission for the action and that something like this should not be happening in a democratic state. South Africa's Department of International Relations and Cooperation said the actions bore the hallmarks of a coup d'etat and called for the military to allow the democratically elected government to return to business. The U.S. said it is deeply concerned by the clashes and, quote, calls upon government officials and all parties to remain committed to peaceful political dialogue and to follow democratic processes in line with the Lesotho Constitution and principles of the rule of law, according to a State Department statement from spokesman Jean Saki. South Africa's ruling African National Congress called upon the African Union and the Southern African Development Community to, quote, monitor the unfolding developments in Lesotho and continue to work with the people of that country to maintain law, order, and democracy, unquote. The demonstration plan for Monday has been called off, according to Lesotho's news agency. The landlocked country first coalition government was formed in 2012 after competitive elections that ousted the 14-year incumbent, Palita Mosididi, who peacefully stepped down from power. The coalition has since been fragile. Lesotho has seen unrest in its past and has seen a number of military coups since gaining independence from Britain in 1966. The constitutional government was restored in 1993 after 7 years of military rule. Violent protests and a military mutiny in 1998 came after a contentious election prompted intervention by the South African Defense Forces, National Defense Forces. Political stability returned after constitutional reforms, and parliamentary elections were peaceably held in 2002. And additional information from the Southern African state of Lesotho, Deputy Prime Minister Moyohoyo Metsing is now running the government after the Prime Minister Thomas Thabane fled the country, accusing the army of staging a coup. A minister reported on Sunday, August the 31st, gunfire rang out in the capital of Maseru yesterday, August the 30th, according to witnesses, who said soldiers patrolled the streets, occupied government buildings, and surrounded Prime Minister Thomas Thabane's official residence. Thabane left with his family for neighboring South Africa after receiving intelligence that he was the target of a military assassination attempt. He said the military action amounts to a coup. In a phone interview with the Voice of America, the Prime Minister said the situation involved, quote, total indiscipline, unquote, in the army. He said soldiers were, quote, running around the streets threatening people, unquote, and, quote, quite openly stating that they want my neck, unquote. Thabane accused a former top military commander of leading the unrest. He said he would return to his country as soon as he knew he, quote, was not going to be killed, unquote. Military officials in Lesotho have denied plotting a coup. Officials said they moved against police elements suspected of trying to arm a political faction. They said soldiers have returned to their barracks, the streets have quieted, and the country has returned to normal. Thabane told the Voice of America the attempt to overthrow his administration stemmed from his fight to root out corruption in Lesotho. He urged the Southern African Development Community, the SADC, to help restore order. A military spokesman, Major Nkidi Ntoyi, said the army only responded to an imminent threat from what he called, quote, political fanatics, unquote, whom members of the police force were trying to arm. Quote, what happened this morning was that the command of the Lesotho Defense Forces was acting after receiving intelligence reports that amongst the police service, there are some elements who are actually planning to arm some of the political youth fanatics who were on the verge of wreaking havoc, unquote, he said. A South African government spokesman, Clayson Monyela, said no one is claiming leadership in Lesotho. However, he said the military's actions have the marking of a push. Quote, although no one has claimed to have taken over government through the use of force, by all accounts, the activities of the Lesotho Defense Forces thus far bear the hallmark of a coup d'etat, unquote, he said. Military officials in Lesotho say soldiers have returned to their barracks and the situation in the country is calm. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Deputy Prime Minister Moyohoyo Metsing said tensions have been high since Thabane made a, quote, unilateral, unquote, decision to dissolve parliament. News reports say some members of the country's military are loyal to Metsing instead of the prime minister. The mountainous kingdom surrounded by South Africa has repeatedly been beset by political instability since gaining independence in 1966. Until then, it had been a British protectorate known as Basutoland. A peaceful election in 2012 produced a three-party coalition government that many observers hoped would bring lasting stability, but the fragile government reportedly collapsed several months ago. In June, South Africa had issued a stern warning to Lesotho after the prime minister suspended the parliament in what appeared to be an attempt to dodge a no-confidence vote. Instability in Lesotho's political system, according to Tom Wheeler, who is a former South African diplomat, who is now an independent analyst, says that, quote, well, I suppose the problem is it's a democracy, unquote, Wheeler said, noting that coalition partners and the opposition disagree, quote, with what the prime minister is doing and therefore have pulled the plug on the coalition. And I think that's the cause of the instability. He went on to say that this man, who's the prime minister, is a democratically elected person from a not majority party, and that sort of instability is built into the system, unquote. Lesotho is a constitutional monarchy with a king whose powers are largely ceremonial. The kingdom has been a British protectorate known as Basutoland prior to 1966. Now, Wheeler said South Africans should not be overly concerned about upheaval in the enclave, despite their history of armed intervention in Lesotho's previous political crises. Quote, "It's not going to be a big issue," unquote, he said, recalling that in 1998, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, a tribal leader who held senior positions in the African National Congress, was South Africa's acting president while Nelson Mandela was abroad. He said in a South African, Southern African Development Community forced to Lesotho to try to prevent a coup. The troops, quote, were repulsed by the Lesotho army. It was a great embarrassment to South Africa, unquote, Williams Wheeler said. Quote, "So I think we would stand back and say, get on with it, boys. It's not our problem," unquote, "and not be worried about it," unquote. And that was an update on developments in the Southern African state of Lesotho. And later on in our program, we'll have additional information on developments in the Southern African state of Lesotho. In Ferguson, Missouri, where a little over 3 weeks ago, 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot dead by a white police officer. Ensuing mass demonstrations and rallies and rebellions drew the attention of the international community. On yesterday, August the 30th, hundreds converged on Ferguson to march for Michael Brown, the unarmed African-American 18-year-old who was shot and killed by a white police officer 3 weeks ago to the day. His death stoked national discourse about police tactics, about racism, which the rally's organizers pledged to continue. Led by Brown's parents and other relatives, Saturday's throng peacefully made their way down Canfield Drive in the St. Louis suburb to a makeshift memorial that marked the spot where Brown was shot August 9th by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. Quote, "We know that his life is not going to be in vain," unquote, the Reverend Spencer Booker of St. Louis St. Paul AME Church said into a megaphone standing in the middle of the street amid candles, placards, stuffed animals, and now wilted flowers. Quote, "We know you're going to even the score, God. We know you're going to make wrong right," unquote. Brown's parents, mother Leslie McSpaden, and father Michael Brown Sr., encircled the memorial with other family members during prayers, including one by a Muslim clergy member. Hours later, hundreds of protesters again gathered in front of the suburban police department and fire station, blocking the road. Fiery speeches by way of speakers mounted to a car gave way to another march with chants, quote, "If we can't have it, we're shutting it down," unquote. Some lobbed angry insults at a line of Ferguson officers and state police who stood guard at a taped-off section of the city's parking lot, but the number of protesters dwindled to double digits by the late afternoon. Wilson, a six-year police veteran, has not yet been charged in the killing of Michael Brown. A St. Louis County grand jury is considering evidence in the case, and federal investigators are sorting out whether Brown's civil rights were violated. There was a muted presence Saturday during the march, which began on West Florissant Avenue, a stretch that became a nexus of nightly protests, some which were contentious and violent, and the destruction of private property in the days after Brown's death drew attention to the national oppression of the African-American people inside the United States. The unrest in Ferguson compelled the Obama administration to make a statement to deploy Justice Department operatives, including Attorney General Eric Holder, to Ferguson in order to calm the unrest, which had gained the attention of people throughout the international community. Now, many of the businesses' windows remain boarded up, though most have been reopened. Missouri Highway Patrol Captain Ron Johnson, whom Missouri governor put in charge of security in Ferguson, put a black face on the blatant racist violence that characterizes the St. Louis suburb. Johnson was there at times posing with the rally attendees for selfies. Now, Saturday morning's gathering, including tailgaters and people hawking T-shirts, memorializing Brown on featuring slogans, quote, "Hands up, don't shoot," unquote, a phrase that reflects what witnesses have said Brown did in surrender before being shot. Police have said the shooting happened after a struggle between Brown and Wilson and Wilson's patrol vehicle, though authorities have said little else, citing the investigation. Quote, "We're just 3 weeks into this, and this is only the beginning of this movement," unquote, said Jarrell Christmas, a St. Louis attorney who helped lead Saturday's march and others in the past, He's intent on keeping Brown and the resulting turmoil and questions, quote, in front of America, unquote. Also coming out of yesterday's demonstration, activists call for mass civil disobedience on highways in and around this St. Louis suburb to protest the killing of an unarmed African-American teenager by a white police officer, with the leaders of one coalition encouraging supporters to stop their cars to tie up traffic on Labor Day, which is Monday, September the 1st, in the United States. The appeal came at a peaceful, if at times tense, march and rally on Saturday, August 30th, that drew what appeared to be well over several thousand demonstrators to some of the same Ferguson streets where the police attacked protesters in the days after the killing of Michael Brown. Mr. Brown, 18, was shot August 9th by a white police officer, Darren Wilson, of the Ferguson Police Department, and his bloody body lay on Canfield Drive for 4 hours and a half before it was removed by the county authorities. Organizers at the rally called on demonstrators to drive on Interstate 70 and other area highways at 4:30 p.m. Monday, turned their hazard lights on and stopped their vehicles for 4.5 minutes to summarize the 4.5 hours that Brown's body lay in the street. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, we'd like to share this following information, that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers and magazines and journals and research reports on blogs and on websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is go to the following URL, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. I am your host. If you want to have access to this program, as well as other archive programs of the Pan-African Journal, all you have to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And in doing that, of course, you can have access to this program as well as other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal, numbering approximately 400. And right now, we're going to go back and listen to some more music for a interlude, and we'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Michael Mike Brown is consigned to the earth. Network newscasters and broadcasters are packing their gear, canceling their hotel rooms, and setting their sights on new wonders, new images, and new stories. That the tragic saga in Ferguson struck national news desks is both rare and unprecedented, given the length and depth of the story. But to reporters, stories come and stories go. And the Brown story is going. Part of the reason is the incessant media chorus for the expulsion of so-called outside agitators, seen as the violence-prone troublemakers coming on the scene. Once gone, tension drained away like an unwanted migraine. And tension, in the words of Martin Luther King Jr., creative tension, is the stuff that animates protests and helps fuel movements. It is the job of the managerial class of lawyers, preachers, and politicians to reduce tensions, to de-radicalize movements, to make them manageable. And once they become manageable, they lose their mass base, and with it, its social power. For the masses know the essential nature of the police, for they see them and gauge them daily. They know them as violent, vicious, and venal government officials, and they are hungry, anxious to oppose them. Movements are a lot like volcanoes, which appear dormant or sleeping. Unseen or underground forces churning, boiling, crashing like waves against a hidden shore. Until one day, usually a day none had foreseen, it erupts, splashing its red molten rage over miles, changing everything. That's what movements do and what they are. If hot enough, they can change everything. Everything. But political, media, and state forces don't want change. They want continuity. For therein lies both their profits and their power. And who wants to lose either of those things? Therefore, the tragedy of Ferguson will be stuffed back into the pillow of forgetfulness. Until next time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that was the voice of the voiceless, Mumia Abu-Jamal. And Mumia Abu-Jamal is still incarcerated in the Pennsylvania criminal justice system. And there's still a movement afoot to get him out of prison. He's no longer on death row, but still confined to the Pennsylvania prison industrial complex. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Sunday, August 31st, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to our program for this week, the Pan-African Journal. And we're broadcasting simultaneously with the ongoing Detroit International Jazz Festival, also being held here in downtown Detroit. And as we mentioned earlier, there's going to be a number of artists that will be performing later on today in downtown Detroit, as well as tomorrow. Later on today, there's, of course, going to be Randy Weston, who performed last night to the wild applause of the audience at the Detroit International Jazz Festival. Weston and his African Rhythms, he'll be performing in a duo with Billy Harper, who also played with Randy Weston's African Rhythms last evening. That'll be at 5:15 p.m. Eastern Time. A set entitled The Roots of Blues. We'll have Al Foster's quartet as well. There'll be a tribute to Miles Davis from Wayne, featuring Wallace Rooney's orchestra. Also, Wayne Shorter's Universe Legend and other rarely heard large jazz works. Ron Carter will be performing tomorrow in a tribute to Jim Hall. And Joshua Redman, who is the 2014 Detroit Jazz Festival Artists in Residence will also be performing tomorrow as well at 4:15 p.m. So this is another award-winning classic 35th annual Detroit International Jazz Festival taking place this weekend in downtown Detroit, and we'll be covering it here at the Pan-African Journal and the Pan-African Newswire. And before we heard the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal, we heard the music of Sonny Stitt with Sonny's Blues. And we're going to hear another song by Kenny Burrell with John Coltrane entitled Why Was I Born? John Coltrane with guitarist Kenny Burrell. And we are paying tribute to the Detroit International Jazz Festival taking place this weekend in downtown Detroit. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Sunday, August 31st, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And as we mentioned before, if you want to have access to this program as well as other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal, numbering some 400 All you have to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that URL is blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And in doing that, you can have access to this program as well as other archived programs of the Pan-African Journal. As we talked about earlier in our Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, developments in the southern African nation of Lesotho has drawn international attention. Right now, we want to bring you a series of reports from the SAFM Radio News out of South Africa, talking about developments in Lesotho as well as other issues involving southern Africa, the African continent, and indeed the international community in general. We'll be right back.
Top stories. AU and SADC called upon to monitor situation in Lesotho and the third Mandela Marathon underway. Good morning with SAFM News at 11. I'm Lulu Gabu. The African National Congress has called upon the African Union and the Southern African Development Community to monitor the unfolding developments in Lesotho to maintain law, order and democracy. Thabo Phagane reports.
The ANC says it has noted with deep concern the developments in the Kingdom of Lesotho, where the military had reportedly seized key buildings and installations. The party says it condemns any attempted seizure of power through unconstitutional means and hopes the Lesotho Defense Force will return to barracks and allow the work of civilian rule and the democratic government to continue unabated. Meanwhile, the Archbishop of Cape Town, Thabo Makgoba, has asked for South Africans to pray for the people of Lesotho. Thabo Phagane, SABC News.
Lesotho's Deputy Prime Minister Matedra Metsing is in charge of government in the absence of Premier Tom Tabane. He was whisked across the border to South Africa after the military surrounded his official residence and police stations in Lesotho's capital, Maseru. Tabane has accused the military of staging a coup. The Lesotho Defense Force has denied attempting a coup. The Ekurhuleni municipality says it expects to restore power to the affected areas by this afternoon. Several areas, including Boksburg, Sunward Park, Freeway Park and the CBD, were left without power since yesterday. Engineers were forced to stop work due to safety risks. The power outage was as a result of an explosion of the incoming circuit breaker from Eskom to Ekurhuleni. The municipality's Hannes Roos.
We're busy replacing the circuit breaker and the bus bars and the insulators and all those things that was damaged due to the mechanical explosion of that. So we will do that during the day and hopefully by before dark we will have the power back.
Some roads in Parktown, Johannesburg have been closed to traffic due to the Jazz on the Lake concert today. Janswas Avenue is closed between Loch Avenue and Bolton Road, and many crossroads are closed between Oxford Road and Zoo Lake. Metro Police spokesperson Wayne Minar says roads would be opened at 8 p.m.
Fans will not be able to access Zoo Lake with private cars and encouraged to use the park and ride facilities which are at Metro Centre, Braamfontein, Auckland Park and Soweto, as well as from Alexandra Stadium.
The third Mandela Marathon is underway in the Pietermaritzburg area. About 10,000 athletes are competing in this 42-kilometer race, which started from Bali Township in Pietermaritzburg and ends at the Mandela Capture Site at Howick. The race traces former President Nelson Mandela's footsteps from the venue of his last speech as a free man at Manaye Hall in Pietermaritzburg to the site of his arrest at Howick. The marathon is aimed at honoring Madiba's legacy through sport and also to make people more aware of his life and his contribution to South Africa's democratic freedom. Amongst the dignitaries at the event are various MECs, other government officials and members of the Mandela family. And finally, further afield, Peru's Interior Ministry says the final tally of the largest ever cocaine seizure this week totaled 7.6 tons. It has been valued at more than $300,000 million. A stack of cocaine was found hidden in a shipment of coal in the Peruvian city of Trujillo and was to have been moved onto Spain and Belgium. Authorities say it belonged to a Mexican drug cartel operating in the country. Recapping our top story, the African National Congress has called upon the African Union and the Southern African Development Community to monitor the unfolding developments in Lesotho to maintain law, order and democracy. For SAFM News, I'm Lulu Gabu. More news at noon.
And that was SAFM News reporting on developments in the Southern Africa region. Let's hear another updated report from SAFM News.
Top stories, action to restore calm in Lesotho and humanitarian aid drops made in northern Iraq. Good morning with SAFM News at 8. I'm Lulu Gabu. Lesotho's Prime Minister Tom Tabane's government, with the assistance of South Africa, are now working towards normalizing the situation in Lesotho and restore calm. Lesotho soldiers have taken over police headquarters in Maseru, as well as radio and television stations. Tabane has denied reports that there has been a coup in the country.
I think that the suspicion that there could be a coup was not totally unjustified. Looking at things in general, there were makings of a coup, but I think it was nipped in the bud and it is not going to take place. What we are doing now in collaboration with South Africa, which has now temporarily taken the chair of the SADC organ on politics, defense and security, we are dealing with the situation in order to normalize it as quickly as possible.
The United States has called for peaceful dialogue in Lesotho. U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki says the U.S. is deeply concerned by the clashes and calls upon government officials and all parties to remain committed to peaceful political dialogue and to follow democratic processes in line with the Lesotho Constitution and principles of the rule of law. Government is fast-tracking investigations into the legal selling of rhino horn. More than 500 rhinos have been killed in parks and game reserves since the beginning of the year. Speaking in Durban, Chairperson of Parliament's Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs, Jackson Mtembu, said the country was sitting on a massive stockpile of rhino horn. He says 18 tons of rhino horn could be sold to flood the market and curb further poaching.
Government has put a team that is looking into the sale, the legal sale of rhino horns. As you will know, we have never sold rhino horns as a country. But in terms of the various conventions, if we are to do so, we need to put that matter before the relevant convention on these endangered species. So we are looking at the merits and demerits on the dehorning of rhinos.
Knysna resident Nicola van Beckel has been lauded by the Cape Floral Kingdom after she discovered a rare fynbos species. She attended the Floral Kingdom Expo at Bredasdorp in the Overberg this weekend. Van Beckel explains how she came across the species.
I take a lot of photographs, especially things that I've never seen before, and I saw this plants that I haven't seen before. It wasn't in flower, but I took photographs of it. And later on, I put the photographs onto iSpot. I was just lucky to have been the person to have photographed it.
And finally, further afield, United States planes have made humanitarian aid drops to the besieged Iraqi town of Amerli in northern Iraq. The Pentagon says aircraft from the United Kingdom, Australia and France joined the U.S. in the humanitarian aid drops. Food, water and medical supplies have been delivered. The Iraqi army, Shia militia and Kurdish fighters have launched an offensive against the militants. The BBC's Jim Muir reports.
The attack involves two main thrusts. One is from the south, with Iraqi army troops and allied Shia militias trying to push into the Hamrin Hills, which overlook the plain on which Amerli lies. With the help of airstrikes by the Iraqi Air Force, they're reported to be making slow progress, with roads in the area heavily mined and booby-trapped by the Islamist militants. From further north, a combination of army forces, Shia militia, and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters is reported to be trying to push down towards Amerli through a string of villages held by the IS radicals.
Recapping our top story, Lesotho's Prime Minister Tom Tabane's government, with the assistance of South Africa, are now working towards normalizing the situation in Lesotho and restoring calm. For SAFM News, I'm Lulu Gabu. Headlines at 8:30. Top stories, Lesotho's Prime Minister flees to South Africa and missing British boy found in Spain. Good morning with SAFM News at 7, I'm Lulu Gabu. Lesotho's Prime Minister Tom Tabane says he fled for his life across the border to South Africa. He accused the military of seizing power in a coup that left the country in flux. Tabane says it was a highly choreographed attempt to oust him from power. In the early hours of yesterday morning, the military seized control of key police facilities in the capital, Maseru. Tabane says he will return when his life is not in danger. He says he will not go back to get killed. At least 4 people, 1 soldier and 4 police were seriously wounded in gunfights. Meanwhile, the South African government is not immediately sending troops to Lesotho following claims that the neighbouring country has been taken over by the military. International relations spokesperson Clayson Munyela says South Africa believes diplomacy should be given a chance and the situation should be resolved through peaceful means. Munyela has called on the Lesotho Defence Force to reinstate the elected government. Munyela says the Southern African Development Community is engaging with all the role players. The United States has called for peaceful dialogue in Lesotho. U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki says the U.S. is deeply concerned by the clashes and calls upon government officials and all parties to remain committed to peaceful political dialogue and to follow democratic processes in line with the Lesotho Constitution and principles of the rule of law. Government is fast-tracking investigations into the legal selling of rhino horn. More than 500 rhinos have been killed in parks and game reserves since the beginning of the year. Speaking in Durban, Chairperson of Parliament's Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs, Jackson Mtembu, says the country was sitting on a massive stockpile of rhino horn. He says 18 tons of rhino horn could be sold to flood the market and curb further poaching.
Government has put a team that is looking into the sale, the legal sale of rhino horns. As you will know, we have never sold rhino horns as a country. But in terms of the various conventions, if we are to do so, we need to put that matter before the relevant convention on these endangered species. So we are looking at the merits and demerits on the dehorning of rhinos.
Knysna resident Nicola van Beckel has been lauded by the Cape Floral Kingdom after she discovered a rare fainball species. She attended the Floral Kingdom Expo at Bredasdorp in the Overberg this weekend. Van Beckel explains how she came across the species.
I take a lot of photographs, especially things that I've never seen before, and I saw this plants that I hadn't seen before. It wasn't in flower, but I took photographs of it. And later on, I put the photographs onto iSpot. I was just lucky to have been the person to have photographed it.
And finally, further afield, a 5-year-old British boy with a brain tumour who was snatched from hospital without medical consent has been found in Spain with his parents. Ashaya King's parents have been arrested and he was admitted to hospital. Police earlier issued a European arrest warrant for 51-year-old Brett King and 45-year-old Nahame King after they drove their son away from a hospital in Southampton in southern England on Thursday. Interpol launched a missing persons alert following a request from British police who led the search. The BBC's Duncan Kennedy reports.
The 3-day search for Asher was brought to an end last night when a Spanish police car spotted his family's vehicle near Malaga. In it were Asher and his parents. Asha was said to be showing no visible signs of distress and is now in the children's hospital in Malaga. Asha's parents, Brett and Nagema King, have been arrested. It's possible the couple may face extradition to the UK.
Recapping our top story, Lesotho's Prime Minister Tom Tabane says he fled for his life across the border to South Africa. For SAFM News, I'm Lulu Gabu. More news at 7:30. Top story, South Africa will not send troops to Lesotho and new sanctions against Russia. Good morning with SAFM News at 6 o'clock. I'm Lulu Gabu. The South African government is not immediately sending troops to Lesotho following claims that the neighbouring country has been taken over by the military. International relations spokesperson Clayson Munyela says South Africa believes diplomacy should be given a chance and the situation should be resolved through peaceful means. Lesotho soldiers have taken over police headquarters in Maseru as well as radio and television stations. Munyela has called on the Lesotho Defence Force to reinstate the elected government. Lesotho Prime Minister Tom Tabane and coalition partner Tshisedi Maseribane have reportedly fled to South Africa. Munyela says the Southern African Development Community is engaging with all the role players. Lesotho's Defence Force meanwhile insists that the situation has returned to normal. It also says Tladi Kamodi remains army chief. It was earlier reported that King Letsie had axed Kamodi and replaced him with Maparangwe Mohau. Army spokesperson Ndeli Ndoi.
Our understanding is derived from the fact that the officer who is said to have been installed as a new commander is the officer who has been suspended from the service and is facing charges before the court martial.
Back on home soil, government is fast-tracking investigations into the illegal selling of rhino horn. More than 500 rhinos have been killed in parks and game reserves since the beginning of the year. Speaking in Durban, Chairperson of Parliament's Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs, Jackson Mtembu, says the country was sitting on a massive stockpile of rhino horn. He says 18 tons of rhino horn could be sold to the to flood the market and curb further poaching.
Government has put a team that is looking into the sale, the legal sale of rhino horns. As you will know, we have never sold rhino horns as a country. But in terms of the various conventions, if we are to do so, we need to put that matter before the relevant convention on these endangered species. So we are looking at the merits and demerits on the dehorning of rhinos.
Knysna resident Nicola van Beckel has been lauded by the Cape Floral Kingdom after she discovered a rare fynbos species. She attended the Floral Kingdom Expo at Bredasdorp in the Overberg this weekend. Van Beckel explains how she came across the species.
I take a lot of photographs, especially things that I've never seen before. And I saw this plant that I haven't seen before. It wasn't in flower, but I took photographs of it. And later on, I put the photographs onto iSpot. I was just lucky to have been the person to have photographed it.
Further afield, African peacekeeping troops and Somali forces have recaptured a southern town from Al-Shabaab rebels, bringing them a step closer to the insurgent stronghold of Barawe. The assault was part of the second phase of an offensive to drive the rebels out of towns, which they have continued to hold since losing control of the capital Mogadishu in 2011. The Somali military says they have secured Bulamarea. African Union Force spokesperson Ali Adin Humed says a Ugandan soldier was killed and two others were wounded. He says scores of rebels died in the fighting. And finally, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko says European Union leaders have agreed to prepare new sanctions against Russia over its intervention in the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Speaking after meeting with EU leaders in Brussels, Poroshenko said that their implementation would depend on the outcome of talks in Minsk about the crisis today. He added that failure to end hostilities could lead to a full-scale war.
I think that we are very close to the point of non-return. Point of non-return is full-scale war. And that's why we undertake the enormous efforts to stop that and to bring the discussion in the diplomatic format, in the diplomatic dialogue.
Recapping our top story, the South African government is not immediately sending troops to Lesotho following claims that the neighboring country has been taken over by the military. For SAFM News, I'm Lulu Gabu, headlines at 6:30.
And welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. We just heard several updated reports from the South Africa FM radio news dealing with various aspects of developments in Southern Africa and indeed throughout the international community in general. And we are here at the Pan-African Journal today, which is Sunday, August 31st, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. If you want to have access to this program, as well as other archived programs of the Pan-African Journal, all you have to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that is at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. By logging on to this website, you can have access to today's program, Sunday, August 31st, 2014, as well as some 400 other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal, dealing with the most pressing and burning issues of the day on the African continent, throughout the African diaspora, and indeed the international community in general. We want to encourage all of our listeners to share these programs with other potential listeners. These programs can be shared via email. They can be hosted on other blogs and websites. They could also be shared through social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. We want to get this information out as broadly as possible, and therefore we want to encourage people to help us in sharing this information that is presented on a weekly basis through the Pan-African Journal. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And today we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. This weekend as well is the Labor Day weekend in the United States. And in the city of Detroit, the 35th annual Detroit International Jazz Festival is taking place as well in downtown Detroit. And we have been covering that event throughout this weekend. It will conclude tomorrow on the official federally recognized Labor Day holiday, September 1st, 2014. And we'll be there tomorrow as well. And we'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And right now we're going to bring you the final in our series of South African FM radio news broadcasts dealing with issues throughout the entire region.
Top stories: AU and SADC called upon to monitor situation in Lesotho and the third Mandela Marathon underway. Good morning with SAFM News at 11. I'm Lulu Gabu. The African National Congress has called upon the African Union and the Southern African Development Community to monitor the unfolding developments in Lesotho to maintain law, order and democracy. Tapo Pagane reports.
The ANC says it has noted with deep concern the developments in the Kingdom of Lesotho, where the military had reportedly seized key buildings and installations. The party says it condemns any attempted seizure of power through unconstitutional means and hopes the Lesotho Defense Force will return to barracks and allow the work of civilian rule and the democratic government to continue unabated. Meanwhile, the Archbishop of Cape Town, Thabo Makgoba, has asked for South Africans to pray for the people of Lesotho. Tshepo Pagane, SABC News.
Lesotho's Deputy Prime Minister Matedra Metsing is in charge of government in the absence of Premier Tom Tabane. He was whisked across the border to South Africa after the military surrounded his official residence and police stations in Lesotho's capital, Maseru. Tabane has accused the military of staging a coup. The Lesotho Defence Force has denied attempting a coup. The Ekurhuleni municipality says it expects to restore power to the affected areas by this afternoon. Several areas, including Boksburg, Sunward Park, Freeway Park and the CBD, were left without power since yesterday. Engineers were forced to stop work due to safety risks. The power outage was as a result of an explosion of the incoming circuit breaker from Eskom to Ekurhuleni. The municipality's Hannes Roos.
We're busy replacing the circuit breaker and the bus bars and the insulators and all those things that was damaged due to the mechanical explosion of that. So we will do that during the day, and hopefully by before dark we will have the power back.
Some roads in Parktown, Johannesburg have been closed to traffic due to the Jazz on the Lake concert today. Janswas Avenue is closed between Loch Avenue and Bolton Road, and many crossroads are closed between Oxford Road and Zoo Lake. Metro Police spokesperson Wayne Minnar says roads would be opened at 8 p.m.
Fans will not be able to access Zoo Lake with private cars and encouraged to use the park and ride facilities which are at Metro Centre, Braamfontein, Auckland Park and Soweto, as well as from Alexandra Stadium.
The third Mandela Marathon is underway in the Pietermaritzburg area. About 10,000 athletes are competing in this 42-kilometer race, which started from Bali Township in Pietermaritzburg and ends at the Mandela Capture Site at Howick. The race traces former President Nelson Mandela's footsteps from the venue of his last speech as a free man at Manaye Hall in Pietermaritzburg to the site of his arrest at Howick. The marathon is aimed at honoring Madiba's legacy through sport and also to make people more aware of his life and his contribution to South Africa's democratic freedom. Amongst the dignitaries at the event are various MECs, other government officials and members of the Mandela family. And finally, further afield, Peru's Interior Ministry says the final tally of the largest ever cocaine seizure this week totaled 7.6 tons. It has been valued at more than $300,000 million. A stack of cocaine was found hidden in a shipment of coal in the Peruvian city of Trujillo and was to have been moved onto Spain and Belgium. Authorities say it belonged to a Mexican drug cartel operating in the country. Recapping our top story, the African National Congress has called upon the African Union and the Southern African Development Community to monitor the unfolding developments in Lesotho to maintain law, order and democracy. For SAFM News, I'm Lulu Gabu. More news at noon.
And welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. We just heard a final installment, a series of reports from South Africa FM Radio News dealing with developments in South Africa, in neighboring Lesotho, as well as Peru, Ukraine, the United States, and other world issues. And right now, we're going to take another brief musical break, and we'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And in the background, we're listening to the music of Rahsaan Roland Kirk with a tune entitled Blues for Alice. And Detroit International Jazz Festival taking place this weekend in downtown Detroit. And coming up as our feature here at the Pan-African Journal, we're going to go into our archives for a Pan-African Journal, a New York City version edition from January 27th, 2014, earlier this year. And the Pan-African Journal is also broadcast in New York City over Community Progressive Radio, that's CPR. Metro.org. The program is hosted by yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, and it is, of course, produced by Bernard White of New York City, who is a producer at CPRMetro.org in New York City. And we'll be heading towards the New York City version of the Pan-African Journal archived edition from earlier this year, out of our vaults from January 27th, 2014, of course, discussing issues that remain foremost in the minds of those concerned with developments in Africa, the diaspora, and indeed the international community in general. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and we'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. Welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And in today's Pan-African Journal, we'll be dealing with some of the following stories. The widow of John Garang, the founder of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, Rebecca Nyadong, has blamed South Sudan President Salva Kiir for the outbreak of violence and unrest that has gripped the country over the last 6 weeks. Meanwhile, allegations have surfaced that both sides have violated a recently signed ceasefire agreement in the oil-rich nation. The newly elected president of the Central African Republic has appointed a prime minister to the troubled nation. Catherine Samba Panza, the new interim president, has designated Andre Nzapayeke, a former official of the African Development Bank, as the new prime minister. At least five Egyptian diplomats have been kidnapped in the neighboring country of Libya amid ongoing unrest inside the country. The abduction of the diplomats is supposedly related to the detention of a militia leader in the neo-colonial state. Also in Libya, pro-Gaddafi forces have seized several towns and an air base in the south of the country. And finally, over 1,000 people have been arrested in protest against military rule during the commemoration surrounding the third anniversary of the uprising in Egypt during 2011. Egypt has been hit by a series of bombings as well as street clashes surrounding the third anniversary of the uprising inside of that country. Rebecca Nyadong de Mabior, the widow of the late John Garang de Mabior, has reiterated her accusations against the South Sudanese president, Salva Kiir, whom she says started the violence that nearly plunged the new nation into civil war. She said Kiir's refusal to allow internal reform in the country's ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the SPLM, and his subsequent decisions to disarm the newer soldiers from his presidential guards triggered the December 15th violence. Naidang said just this last past Friday, January the 24th, that she told this to the London Evening Post, that Kiir had illegally trained a private army of 15,000 men from his ethnic group, which he used to start the violence in the South Sudanese capital of Juba. She claimed the violence was planned by President Kiir, who chairs the SPLM, and his group when the former vice president and party deputy chairman, Riek Machar, and his colleagues, herself included, declined to attend a second day of the National Liberation Council meeting because of Kiir's, quote, divisive and non-reconciliatory, unquote, speech during the opening of the meeting a day before. Quote, they, the Kiir group, may have thought that these people did not come to the meeting, and so they were maybe planning a coup. So they made a decision that these people would be arrested. Some of them said they would try to make something so they could accuse these people of planning a coup and arrest them. This is what happened, unquote, Naidang told a London-based publication. It was then, she added, that President Kiir and his group began to implement the plan to disarm the newer ethnic group elements in his presidential guards before they could execute their plan of arresting Machar and his colleagues. Her narration of the events leading to the violence, however, seemed to rhyme with the earlier claims by some South Sudanese officials whom the Sudan Tribune talked to on these same matters. Quote, this thing happened in his Kiir's headquarters when they went there. They wanted to disarm a group of Nuers. They went in and found that in the president's headquarters, there were many soldiers belonging to the Nuer ethnic group. Their commander then went to the chief of the general staff and asked what he could do. He was then told to leave the Nuer soldiers until the next morning, unquote, she further narrated. The widow of the founding father of the new nation, however, said Kiir's presidential commander did not listen to the advice of his chief of general staff, James Hoth Mai, and instead went ahead to disarm the newer soldiers. Quote, but the officers did not listen to his orders and proceeded to try and disarm the newer soldiers. This was the time when this thing erupted and war begun in the headquarters of the president, unquote, she added. She also narrated how her senior colleague, Machar, succeeded to escape immediately after the violence erupted. Quote, so some of them, the newer soldiers, went home to Reich's house to get him out because if he had been in his house, he would have been killed, unquote, she added, adding that his home was immediately targeted by Kiir's private army. Quote, if you went to Juba, the capital of South Sudan, now you could see the way his house was destroyed. And it is not his private house. It is a government house. It was destroyed by Tiger, Kiir's army, unquote, Naidang said, adding, quote, and then the soldiers who were in Dr. Reich's house, about 34 of them were all killed, were murdered, unquote. She said that Machar's bodyguards were told by the army chief to disarm in order to leave them free, but were later on allegedly murdered by Kiir's forces, which he called Tiger, in memory of the battalion he commanded during the long civil war with the Republic of Sudan in the north. Quote, the chief of the general services staff had told some people to disarm them, the Nuer soldiers, after telling them he was saving their lives by disarming them. These people, Kiir's Tiger's troops, came and killed all of them, she further lamented. Quote, so when they came in, they targeted massacring Nuer members. A lot of officials, administrators in Juba were killed. This is what literally happened, unquote, added Naidang. The Sudanese leader was accused and has accused the international community over their refusal to condemn what he said was a failed coup attempt by those opposed to his leadership in the Republic of South Sudan. And the fighting inside of South Sudan has been going on now for approximately 6 weeks. There was a ceasefire that was agreed upon just this last past Thursday, January the 23rd. And, of course, as a result of this ceasefire, there has been somewhat of a normalization of the situation inside of the Republic of South Sudan in the capital, but there have been reports of a violation of the ceasefire in various areas of the country where fighting had been taking place. The South Sudanese Army on Friday, January the 24th, denied carrying out attacks on rebels' positions after the signing of the ceasefire agreement in Addis Ababa, although a United Nations spokesperson said clashes took place in different parts of the new nation. Quote, there have been no reports of fighting received today, being the 25th, Saturday, January the 25th. It has been quiet, unquote, and that's according to Colonel Philip Aguirre of the Sudan People's Liberation Army. He's a spokesman for the SPLA, and he told this to reporters in the capital of Juba just this last past Friday, January the 24th. Presidential spokesperson Atini Wekatini denied in a news briefing on Friday, January the 24th, that government forces carried out attacks on rebel-held positions inside the country. Quote, it has been calm today. The government had given out orders to soldiers not to fight anybody from now on. So it is incorrect that there has been fighting, unquote, Atini said. Quote, the situation has been quiet as far as I know. There has not been fighting since yesterday, unquote, the presidential spokesperson stressed on Friday, January the 24th. He further alleged that the rebel delegation negotiating team had no control over their fighters on the ground. Quote, we hope the rebels will do the same so that their honor so that they honor their signature, unquote, Atini said. The two officials were reacting to statements made on Friday, January the 24th, during the morning hours by the rebel SPLM-A in opposition, accusing the government forces in the Unity State of attacking their positions in areas of Dandouk, about 50 kilometers south of Bentiu, the Unity State capital, and in neighboring Upper Nile State. In line with the succession of hostilities agreement signed on January the 23rd, the two warring parties committed themselves to, quote, immediately cease all military operations and freeze their forces at the places they are in, unquote. Now, on Friday evening, January the 24th, former vice president and SPLM and opposition leader, Riek Machar, claimed that the government forces loyal to President Salva Kiir attacked their positions in Unity and in Upper Nile states. The rebel leader further confirmed to Sudan Tribune the attack on his forces in Dandouk, adding that the second attack in Unity State was launched in Dwa, which is about 70 kilometers from Bentiu, the capital of Unity State. Quote, the government forces moved out of Bentiu and attacked our forces in Dandouk, about 50 kilometers south of Bentiu, unquote, Machar said, adding that, quote, the SPLA forces in Bor Town on Friday, January the 24th, moved out and also launched military offensives against the rebel-held positions in Matiang near Bor, unquote. Machar also said that other attacks were launched against his forces in Adar area of the Upper Nile State. He condemned the attacks, which he said were, quote, violations of a succession of hostilities agreement signed on Thursday, January the 23rd, by the two parties in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa, where the African Union is headquartered. Peter Wright Yu, the rebels' spokesperson in Unity State, also told the Sudan Tribune that their forces managed to repel the attack in Gwake County and claimed that the SPLA forces were trying to reach the area and the Tarjaf oil fields, which are located in the area. You said that the SPLM-A in opposition have no intentions to retaliate, but added that they would continue to defend their territory. The rebel spokesperson claimed that they captured five vehicles as well as ammunition from government troops. The Sudan Tribune was unable to reach Unity State's deputy governor for comments just this last past Friday, January the 24th. Now, speaking at a press conference at the United Nations headquarters in New York on Friday, Farhan Haq, a spokesperson for the United Nations Secretary General, confirmed that there were clashes in South Sudan despite the signing of a succession of hostilities agreement. Quote, The mission, the United Nations mission in South Sudan, UNMISS, says that sporadic fighting took place in parts of the country today, unquote, Hawk said, during urging the two parties to implement the agreement, quote, in full and immediately, unquote. Quote, the UN calls on all communities to cease hostilities and refrain from any act that could harm individuals and properties or lead to further displacement, unquote, he further emphasized. 500,000 South Sudanese have been displaced during the five-week-old conflict, according to United Nations estimates. Mediation on Thursday that said that it would stop the negotiations from January 24th to February the 7th in order to establish a monitoring and verification mechanisms and other panels related to the implementation of the signed agreements. Hawk pointed out that the establishment of a fully functioning ceasefire monitoring mechanism is essential for the implementation of the agreement. The spokesperson repeated that the, quote, United Nations stands ready to provide critical support to the process, unquote. Last December, the United Nations Security Council increased the number of peacekeepers in South Sudan to nearly 14,000 military and police personnel to protect civilians and eventually to participate in the monitoring of the ceasefire before a political agreement is reached. On Friday, the 15-member body issued a press statement welcoming the truth signing by the government and the dissident delegation. In addition, the Security Council, quote, called on all parties to immediately and fully implement this agreement as the first step in a longer process of ensuring durable peace and rule of law in South Sudan and addressing the underlying causes of the conflict through an inclusive and comprehensive political dialogue, national reconciliation, and building effective state institutions. And at least three aid workers were killed and several properties looted after unidentified armed elements stormed the premises of the United Nations and other aid agencies in South Sudan's Jonglei state. The violence that erupted in mid-December in the capital of Juba last year killed over 1,000 people and displaced more than 500,000. That's according to figures supplied by the United Nations. Several South Sudanese aid workers were reportedly wounded or are still missing after an attack by armed men on civilians sheltered in United Nations bases or fleeing the violence. Despite all the difficulties, aid agencies said they have continued to deliver food to the people in the base, including flying in much-needed water and other sanitation facilities. And in regard to the situation in South Sudan, the president of the Republic of South Sudan, Salva Kiir Mayardit, said that he met with the heads of the United Nations mission in the country for the first time since accusing the agency of interfering in the new nation's internal affairs. Now, in a stinging rebuke earlier last week, Kiir accused the world body of seeking to run a parallel government alongside his administration in Juba. Relations were further strained after the Minister of Information was refused entry to the United Nations compound in Jonglei State in the capital of Bor during an official visit just this last past Sunday, reportedly because he was accompanied by two armed bodyguards. The incident was captured on camera and broadcast on South Sudan television on Sunday evening, with the South Sudanese government demanding a written apology from the United Nations mission in South Sudan, UNMISS. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon released a statement from New York on Monday condemning the attempted forced entry by government officials, saying that United Nations staff had been threatened by armed soldiers. The incident in Bor sparked protests in the capital of Juba, with thousands of political and civil society representatives taking to the streets on Tuesday of last week, accusing the United Nations mission in South Sudan of its leader, Hilda Johnson, of bias and demanding that she be replaced. However, in an interview with the Sudan Tribune on Friday of last week, South Sudanese Foreign Affairs Minister Banaba Marial Benjamin said the government continued to work in partnership with the United Nations mission in South Sudan. He said that, quote, the demonstration by the citizens should be considered as part of the democratic expression about anything they wanted to draw the attention of all the stakeholders. It was not an attack on the United Nations. The government remains committed to provide protection to staff of the United Nations mission in South Sudan, unquote, he said. Marielle said the meeting between the president and Johnson had focused on ways to amicably resolve issues between the two sides so as to avoid further misunderstandings. UNMISS bases across the country are currently sheltering some 73,000 civilians who have been forced to flee their homes after violence erupted in Juba on December the 15th before spreading to other regions of South Sudan. In New York, the United Nations Security Council issued a statement reiterating its, quote, unwavering support for the United Nations mission in South Sudan, unquote, and underlying its vital mission on behalf of the international community to protect civilians in South Sudan. The United Nations Security Council members further expressed their appreciation for the United Nations mission in South Sudan and as well as their personnel, quote, who put their own lives at risk daily pursuing this mandate, and for the 67 troop and police contributing countries whose forces continue to perform admirably under difficult circumstances, unquote, he emphasized in the statement. And with that, that will conclude our updated report on developments in the Republic of South Sudan, where the two opposing forces have signed a ceasefire just this last past Thursday, January the 23rd, during their talks in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's program. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Inside the troubled nation of the Central African Republic, there has been appointed a new interim president, Catherine Samba Panza, who is the former mayor of the capital of Bangui. President Samba Panza now has appointed a new interim Prime Minister, Andre Nzepayeke. The Central African Republic's new interim president, Catherine Samba Panza, named Andre Nzepayeke, who is a former official of the African Development Bank, as the new prime minister. And this was announced over the state radio in the capital of Bangui on Saturday, January the 25th. Now, Samba Panza, who took office just 2 days before, is seeking to build an interim government to restore order to the former French colony after months of sectarian violence that has left thousands dead and homeless inside the mineral-rich nation. The mineral-rich country descended into chaos in March of 2013 when Muslim armed groups known as the Seleka Coalition seized power in a coup d'etat, unleashing a wave of killings and lootings. That triggered revenge attacks by Christian militias known as the Antabalaka forces or anti-machete, and fighting has escalated in recent days despite the presence of about 1,600 French troops and 5,000 African Union peacekeepers. A Muslim former minister was hacked to death by a machete-wielding militiaman in Bangui on Friday, January the 24th. At least 9 others were killed when bands of people, some of them from Christian groups, attacked and looted shops in the mostly Muslim Miskini neighborhood in the capital of Bangui, and this is according to witnesses on the ground inside the Central African Republic. The violence has killed more than 2,000 people since December and forced about 1 million people, nearly a quarter of the population, to flee their homes. Of course, inside the Central African Republic, the situation remains tense despite the appointment of a new president who was just appointed last week inside the troubled Central African state. There's been, of course, much discussion about sending in a contingent of European Union troops to add to the existing 1,600 French troops, as well as between 4,000 and 5,000 African peacekeeping troops who are also in the country as well, from Chad, as well as the Republic of Congo and Rwanda. Now, according to a report by Amnesty International that was released on January the 24th, Christian militiamen killed a prominent Muslim who was a former government minister who supported last year's rebellion led by the Salafi coalition that resulted in the ascendancy to power to President Michelle Jotedaya, who was deposed about 2 weeks ago at an international meeting in the Chadian capital of N'Djamena. Of course, the killing of the former government minister, who is a Muslim, raises the specter of further sectarian bloodshed as tensions deepened at the beginning of the weekend on Friday, January the 24th. Meanwhile, Amnesty International reported that more than 50 Muslims had been killed in two attacks earlier this month in villages that are northwest of the capital of Bangui. More than 1,000 people died during several days of sectarian fighting in December, and United Nations officials have warned that the anarchy could escalate into genocide. Hundreds more have been slain in recent weeks by marauding gangs, wielding machetes, clubs, and other weapons. Now, Dr. Joseph Kalite, a former health minister who had supported the Seleka coalition leader, Michelle Jotedaya, who was the interim president up until several weeks ago, was assassinated on Friday, January the 24th. That's according to El Hajj Wanaga Kabara, an official at the central mosque in the capital of Bangui. Now, witnesses said Kalite died from machete wounds after his car was attacked by Christian militia fighters. News of Kalite's death sent shockwaves of fresh fear through Bangui's Muslim community and prompted several religious authorities to condemn international peacekeeping forces for failing to sufficiently protect Muslims. Quote, the imams announced that starting today, they will let their followers decide themselves which reactions they deem most appropriate to this new provocation, unquote, said Amadou Tinjana Musa Naibe, the imam at the central mosque in the capital of Bangui. Jotedaya and the mostly Muslim rebels who overthrew the government last year became deeply despised by the Christian majority because of killings and other atrocities that they committed. For nearly 10 months, the rebels known as the Seleka Coalition targeted and tortured civilians, in some cases tying them together and throwing them off bridges to drown. The Muslim population in the Central African Republic only comprises some 15% of the overall number of people inside the country of 4.7 million people. In response, the Christian fighters have in fact carried out brutal killings of Muslims in the streets of the capital of Bangui, sometimes stoning them to death and then mutilating their bodies. Muslim civilians who have fled by the tens of thousands insist they are not to blame for the rebellion, which was aided by foreign fighters from Chad as well as Sudan. Now, Jotedaya stepped aside just 2 weeks ago, and interim president Catherine Samba Panza is now tasked with organizing elections later on in 2014. Some 4,600 African peacekeepers are in the Central African Republic, but 3,200 of them remain inside the capital of Bangui. France has also sent 1,600 troops, though few have reached the hotspots that are located further north of the capital of Bangui. Amnesty International called for the peacekeepers to deploy more robustly in the countryside to prevent revenge attacks. Quote, the Christian community has suffered enormously over the past year, unquote, said Joanne Marna, who is the Amnesty International Senior Crisis Advisor in the capital of Bangui. Quote, the desire for revenge is palpable in the Central African Republic. Given how predictable such killings are, more robust peacekeeping steps should be taken to prevent them. The London-based Amnesty International organization said that in one of the attacks on January the 14th, Christian militiamen stopped a truck that included Muslims fleeing the country and demanded that they get out of the vehicle. One mother managed to save her seven-month-old baby's life by handing the child to a Christian woman beside her, whispering her family's name before exiting the vehicle to face death, Amnesty International reported. The infant was later reunited with relatives. The mother was among eight killed by Christian militia fighters. And of course, there's broad speculation over the impact of the assassination of the former minister in the Central African Republic just this last past week. Officials in the Central African Republic, of course, have announced that a Christian militia had killed a former governmental health minister who had supported last year's seizure of power by Michel Djotodia. And, of course, news of Kalite's death sent a lot of shockwaves throughout the country. Of course, the mostly Muslim coalition, which overthrew the government of Francois Bozizé, was, of course, targeted and accused of committing all types of atrocities inside of the country. Of course, the Central African Republic is one of the leading uranium producers in Central Africa. The country also has gold and diamonds. The United States, Canada, France, as well as the Republic of South Africa have, of course, various forms of economic interests inside of the Central African Republic. And as a result of this, the country is considered very important in regard to the struggle that is taking place inside of the country. And that was an updated report on developments inside the Central African Republic, where over the last several months, fighting has intensified between supporters of the Seleka Coalition, comprised of Muslim militia personnel, against the anti-Balaka forces, which are principally Christian militia groups that were organized ostensibly to defend themselves against members of the Rebel Seleka Coalition. The assassination of a former health minister just this last past week, of course, have raised tensions inside of this mineral-rich country. And we're going to take another brief break. We'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Five Egyptian diplomats have been kidnapped in the Libyan capital of Tripoli in retaliation for Egypt's arrest of a Libyan militia chief. This is according to reports that surfaced on Saturday, January the 25th. Gunmen snatched four diplomatic staff from their homes in the Libyan capital on January 25th, including the cultural attaché, and the kidnapped and also kidnapped another diplomatic personnel on Friday, January the 24th, forcing Cairo to evacuate its embassy and its Benghazi consulate in the eastern region of Libya. The kidnapping of so many diplomats underlined Libya's persistent chaos 2 years after Muammar Gaddafi's overthrow and the brutal murder of Muammar Gaddafi by heavily armed rebels who, in fact, had been trained by the United States. Also in regard to developments taking place in the North African state of Egypt, just this last past week, it represented the third anniversary of the 2011 uprising that led to the overthrow of the former dictator, Hosni Mubarak, who had ruled the country for some 30 years. According to the official Egyptian military-backed government, 1,079 people were arrested as a result of demonstrations surrounding the third anniversary of the 2011 uprising. A total, according to government figures, a total of 1,079 people were arrested across Egypt on the third anniversary of the January 25th revolution. This is according to statistics presented by the Interior Ministry. They announced this in a statement on Saturday, January the 25th. Security forces said it had prevented, quote, the Muslim Brotherhood's terrorist plot to disrupt celebrations, unquote, by, quote, attempting to block roads, chanting hostile slogans, and attempting to provoke riots, unquote. Now, some of those arrested were accused of possessing Molotov cocktails and fireworks, live ammunition, and birdshot rifles. The fiercest clashes, according to the statement, took place in Al-Maskan and the Al-Matariya districts of Anshams in East Cairo, where Brotherhood supporters allegedly fired birdshots. Several police officers were injured in the clashes. According to the health ministry, at least 29 civilians were killed on Saturday, January the 25th, as violence erupted in Cairo, in Giza, in Upper Egypt's Minya's governorate, Alexandria, as well as in other cities. In addition to the Brotherhood lawless, police also clashed with secular anti-Brotherhood and anti-military protesters as well. Now, prior to the open clashes that took place leading up to the third anniversary of the Egyptian uprising, a car bomb detonated on Saturday, January the 25th, outside the Central Security Forces camp in the city of Suez. 16 people were injured in the attack. The Ministry of Health said this in a statement. According to eyewitnesses, there have been ongoing clashes at the site between unknown militants and security forces around the camp using live ammunition. The explosion at the Suez police camp resulted from a car bomb and not a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, as previously reported in several news outlets, said General Abdel Fattah Usman, Egypt's Deputy Interior Minister for Media Affairs. Four were injured in the attack and transferred to Suez General Hospital, according to a source in Suez's ambulance authority who spoke with Akram Arabic news website. Now, many political groups marked the 2011 uprising's third anniversary with celebrations as well as demonstrations, despite the deadly bombings that took place in the days leading up to the third anniversary commemorations. Four deadly attacks in the greater Cairo area took place on Friday, January the 24th. They seem to have added insult to injury ahead of the anticipated third anniversary of the 2011 revolution, with conflicting parties poised for escalation. Now, this is according to an article written by Sharif Tariq and Usman El Shanoubi, who wrote this article for the state-run Al Aram news website. Now, continued attempts to gain supporters for its demonstrations on Saturday's anniversary, the Muslim Brotherhood claimed that, quote, most people have put their differences aside and are calling to revive the January 25th, 2011 revolution, unquote. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been deemed a terrorist organization by the military-backed Egyptian government, added that the sporadic bombings were meant to, quote, dismantle the unity of the people, unquote. Interior Minister Mohammed Ibrahim had, however, encouraged citizens to celebrate the anniversary after liberal political groups like the Waf Party and the Free Egyptians Party, along with the Tamarad, the group which spearheaded the protests leading to Morsi's ouster at the hands of the military on July 3rd, have called for Egyptians to join festivities on Saturday, January the 25th, in Tahrir Square. Thousands gathered in Tahrir Square. Those who had control of Tahrir Square were those who supported General al-Sisi, as well as the military control of Egypt. Now, after the bombings, Ibrahim assured that the efforts by those who seek to reign terror inside the country would not ruin the planned celebrations, and assured that the celebrations would be secure. Nonetheless, violence continued around Tahrir Square and in other parts of the capital of Cairo, as well as other regions of the country. Now, Friday's violence began at dawn when a truck bomb ripped through Cairo's central police station, killing four and injuring 76 others. This is according to a report issued by the Egyptian Health Ministry. Hours later, in Giza, one person was killed when a primitive bomb exploded after being thrown at a moving police vehicle near a metro station, Deputy Giza Security Chief Mahmoud Farouk told the state-run television. At least 11 others were reportedly wounded in the attacks. and a third explosion later on Friday, January the 24th, during the morning hours. A small bomb went off at the police station in Talbiya District near the pyramids in Giza. No casualties were reported from the attack, according to the Interior Ministry. The day's fourth attack, however, a small bomb that detonated near the Giza Security Directorate killed one and injured another, bringing the bombing death toll to six persons. Ansar Biyat al-Mahdi, the Partisans of Jerusalem, a supposedly al-Qaeda-inspired group, has claimed responsibility for Friday's attacks at Cairo police headquarters. The group, which has claimed the deadliest militant attacks in Egypt following the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi, has warned Egyptians in a statement not to take to the streets over the next few days. The group had claimed a host of other attacks. They also claimed responsibility for a failed an assassination attempt on the Interior Ministry in Cairo during September of 2013, along with a rocket attack directed at Israel and dozens of attacks in 2012 on a gas pipeline linking Egypt, Jordan, and the State of Israel. Yet, even after the day's violence, some groups remain determined to celebrate the anniversary of the uprising. The Tamarad movement said that it would still, of course, celebrate the anniversary despite the actions of the bombers. Now, the Brotherhood, which has been staging near daily protests since Morsi's ouster, had aimed to make the most of the anniversary of the uprising on Saturday, January the 25th, by reversing what it described as a military coup that took place on July 3rd of 2013. Now, pulling back from its normal antagonism against its opponents, the Muslim Brotherhood issued a statement earlier in the week calling for unity. It also took the first step forward, admitting past wrongdoings, insisting that it had been mistaken in, quote, assuming good intent, unquote, when the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, the SCAF, handed power to the group following the 2012 presidential elections, which saw the Brotherhood-affiliated Morsi elected as president and as representative of the Freedom and Justice Party. Brotherhood has been repeatedly attacked by its opponents for remaining silent during the many clashes that occurred with police and army during the SCAF's brief rule. Some of these groups will take part in and did take part in the protest that took place on January the 25th and in the days to come, insisting that they refuse to coordinate with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Path of the Revolution Front, a coalition of several political groups such as the Revolutionary Socialists, the liberal April 6th Youth Movement, and the Strong Egypt Party, led by Brotherhood leader Abdel Muneim Abu Fatou, who was a former leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. They planned to hold demonstrations on Saturday, January the 25th, along with other independent advocates as well as advocacy groups. The coalition had condemned both the interim government and the Brotherhood. In a statement published just this last past Wednesday, it accused the current regime of attempting to destroy the January 25th revolution and insisted that it will protest the third anniversary of the uprising, in order to reclaim the ideals which initially brought Egyptians into the streets during the early weeks of 2011. The coalition was organizing two main marches that took place on Saturday, January the 25th. One was on Tahrir Square, where celebrations took place. That was according to a statement that was issued by the Way of Revolution Front, its founding member, Mohammed Ibrahim. He told this to the Aram Online during an interview. Now, Ibrahim insisted that his group has not coordinated with the Muslim Brotherhood and that the front's plans had been unaffected by the bombings. Several political forces had already decided not to go into the streets prior to the attacks that took place just this last past Friday, January the 24th. Parties known to advocate the demands of the January 25th revolution had chosen not to directly call for celebrations or protests. An example is the Egyptian Social Democratic Party, the ESDP, the party of Egypt's interim prime minister, Hazim El Beblawi. The ESDP senior member, Atif Adli, told Al-Aram Online Arabic website that the party won't participate and would not participate so as to avoid any possible clashes with the Brotherhood. Adler stressed, though, that the anniversary is an important day and said that his party organized visits to those injured in the uprising and the families of those who were martyred. The Salafist Nur Party had likewise advised Egyptians not to join the demonstrations that took place on Saturday, January the 25th, expressing fears that all gatherings will inevitably lead to bloody clashes. Also showing reservations about just this last past Saturday's demonstrations was the Liberal Constitution Party, founded by Egyptian politician Mohamed El Baradei, who was the former director of the International Atomic Energy Agency for the United Nations. He broke ties with both the party and the government in protest against the degree of violence used in clearing out the two pro-Morsi camps last August that resulted in the deaths of hundreds and some say thousands of Muslim Brotherhood supporters who had encampments to protest the military coup led by General al-Sisi on July 3rd of 2013. The party released a statement just this last past Thursday, January the 23rd, condemning what it said were attempts to reconsolidate Mubarak's police state and political influence, and calling on interim President Ali Mansour to revise a recently passed protest law, which it blamed for the current detention of political activists who took part in the January 25th uprising as well as the June 30th uprising against Morsi during 2013. The party's media secretary, Khalid Daoud, told Aram Online that the party will not participate in the celebrations of the January 25th uprising on that day or in future days following January the 25th. He said, however, that the party's youth will participate in protests organized by the Path of the Revolution Front. The death toll in clashes on the third anniversary of the January 25th uprising had risen to 5, according to a health minister, as of Saturday, January the 25th. Overall, during the course of the demonstrations between Thursday, January the 23rd, and Sunday, January the 26th, it was reported that some 49 Egyptians lost their lives in clashes as well as bomb attacks surrounding the third anniversary of the uprising. Two were reported killed in Upper Egypt's Minya during a crackdown by police on protests by supporters of the ousted president, Mohamed Morsi. Of course, one was killed in Giza's Mohandesin clashes that erupted when security forces dispersed two separate demonstrations, one by the way of the Revolution Front and one by the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. One was also confirmed killed in clashes in Cairo. Clashes have also taken place in downtown Cairo, where several demonstrators clashed near the gathering that was supported by the military-backed government in Tahrir Square, as security forces cracked down on protesters chanting against the military rule, and some, of course, in the secular community also chanted against the Muslim Brotherhood. One woman had been confirmed killed in Alexandria during the clashes. Meanwhile, thousands of supporters of the interim government continue to celebrate the anniversary of the uprising in Tahrir Square and other squares around the country. Also, during developments surrounding the third anniversary of the January 25th uprising in Egypt, the April 6th youth movement, Democratic Front, announced that one of its members, Saeed Wiza, died from a bullet wound after police attacked a march from the journalist syndicate in downtown Cairo. The march of secular and independent groups opposed to both the Muslim Brotherhood and the military regime had left from the press syndicate and began to march to nearby Tahrir Square when they were met by pro-military supporters, and it resulted in violent clashes. Police arrived shortly afterwards and dispersed both camps with birdshot and tear gas. Security forces told the Akram Online that at least 300 people had been arrested in protest on Saturday, January the 25th. In the aftermath of the clashes on Saturday, January 25th, the anti-military group said its priority is to save the lives of its members following the clashes with security forces on Saturday. the Way of the Revolution Front, an anti-military as well as an anti-Muslim Brotherhood coalition group that participated in Saturday's demonstration on the third anniversary of the January 2011 uprising, then urged its members to end their protests following clashes with the security forces. Police had fired tear gas and birdshot to break up the protests, and these protests took place in the Gaza district of Mahdasin. They took place early on Friday, January the 24th. Members of the group later regrouped in downtown Cairo before being attacked by the police once again. Quote, the front is urging all of its members and those who answered its call to commemorate the revolution anniversary to completely withdraw from protests, unquote, the group said on its official Facebook page. Quote, the excessive forces that police are using against whoever tried to express their opinion is a major crime, while at the same time they were protecting their supporters in Tahrir Square, unquote. Thousands of supporters of the transitional authorities, and particularly of the armed forces chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, have gathered in Tahrir Square inside central Cairo beginning on Friday afternoon. Police guarded their demonstration while breaking up other demonstrations that opposed military rule in Egypt. The Way of the Revolution Front was launched last September in 2013, aiming to provide an alternative to the ongoing polarization between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood. And with that, that is an updated report on developments taking place in the North African state of Egypt, where over the last several days, people have commemorated the third anniversary of the 2011 uprising. The supporters of the military government of President al-Sisi and interim President Ali Mansour were protected by the police and military forces, while other protests organized by the Muslim Brotherhood, as well as the Way of Revolution Front, their demonstrations were attacked by the same security forces. And we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with our concluding reports for this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. In the North African state of Libya, several cities in the south of the country have been seized by supporters of the ousted and martyred former leader of the Jemahiriya of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi. The Tamanhint Air Base, some 30 kilometers northeast of Sabah in the south of the country, is reported to be back in pro-Gaddafi hands after the Tabu ethnic group forces from Marzouk, who were guarding it, withdrew their forces. They unilaterally pulled out on January the 20th during the evening hours, claiming that the government was deliberately exploiting clashes in Sabah between the Tabus and the Alad Saliman in order to divert attention from moves to replace it with a new administration. It has not been possible to confirm the allegations. The air base was first seized on Saturday, on January the 18th, by pro-Gaddafi elements, but they then withdrew by the evening that day as government forces led by Marzouk's unit approached. Quote, Ali Zidane is the one who contributed to the worsening situation in the south of the country in an attempt to divert attention, unquote. That was stated by the head of the Marzouk Military Council, Colonel Bakar Waduko. He told this to the international media on January the 21st. He said he had withdrawn all of his troops from the base. Waduku accused the prime minister of increasing tensions in the south of Libya, particularly around Sabah, the air base near Sabah, and the Sarir oil fields, in an attempt to undermine calls for his removal on the basis that with the country's security under threat, Libya could not afford a change of government. He said that the U.S.-backed leader, Prime Minister Ali Zidane, was being deliberately partial. He was supporting one group and neglecting others. He claimed that the situation in the south of Libya, particularly the animosity between the Tabus and the Alad Suleiman, was getting worse despite best efforts of various mediators to promote reconciliation. Waduku appeared, however, not to be overly concerned that his decision to withdraw from the airbase had allowed pro-Qaddafi forces an opening. He said that forces from Misrata were on their way to ensure law and order in the area. Misratan forces headed south last weekend following a meeting in Misrata between the Defense Minister Abdullah Altini and Misrata local councils and other Misratan officials, but they went on to Jufar rather than going to Sabah. Forces from Zintan are also expected to head towards Sabah to help secure the area. Clashes have continued in the southern regional capital. It was reported this afternoon, that was on January the 21st, that conditions had quieted down, but that there were clashes during the night, which had resulted in the deaths of three workers, and also nine people had been wounded, and they had also been taken to a medical center. Shops and businesses have remained closed. This is according to the Libyan news agency, LANA. Meanwhile, on January the 20th, National Security Directorate in Sabah warned that the lack of human and financial resources from the authorities was exacerbating the crisis inside the south of Libya. At a meeting on January the 20th, it was said that it was trying to its best to maintain security, but that it lacked the wherewithal to ensure the safety of the banks, the businesses, and other institutions, and to maintain law and order in the streets. It also emerged on January 20th that three journalists from Faizan Television, who were covering the January 18th seizure of the Tamanhint Air Base by the pro-Qaddafi forces. The Tamanhint Air Base is located 30 kilometers northeast of Sabah, were captured and beaten by attackers. According to Nabil El-Sukni, a presenter with Faizan Television, the three cameramen, Zidane El-Makdi, presenter, and Adim El-Sharif and coordinator Abdallah Abu Abdah, were grabbed by pro-Qaddafi forces while filming at the airbase. He told the Libya Herald that they had been, quote, beaten and tortured, unquote, by the attackers with injuries to their faces and bodies. He indicated that when the attackers fled the base on Saturday, January the 18th, during the evening hours, after which Sabah pro-government forces had arrived, they took the reporters with them. They were released yesterday evening, he said. The three have said nothing about the identities of the attackers other than that they were pro-Qaddafi forces. El-Sukni called on media organizations in Libya to work together to ensure that the press could operate freely and not be subjected to attacks. And as a result of the seizure of several cities and an airbase by pro-Qaddafi forces in South Libya, there's been general panic in the capital of Tripoli. The neo-colonial U.S.-backed government in Tripoli assured the public in a press release on January the 21st that no foreign troops had entered Libyan territory through its southeastern borders. The government added in its press release that, quote, these elements and groups that are broadcasting these rumors are attempting to cause confusion and anxiety among its citizens. The statement also said that the government therefore assures everyone that the situation on the borders is normal and that no forces have entered through the borders to Libyan territory, unquote. This statement comes on the back of rising tensions in various parts of Libya as a group of pro-Qaddafi forces occupy the Tamanhint Air Force Base about 35 kilometers northeast of Sabah, as well as engaging in skirmishes in Sabah, as well as in the worst Shafana area. There was also attacks on the Italian War Cemetery in Tripoli by a group of Qaddafi supporters who were waving the green flag that was the official symbol of the Jamahiriya during the days of Muammar Qaddafi. Upon the outbreak of clashes in Sabah, reporters indicate that the incidents were initiated by a group of foreign fighters from Chad. This news, of course, has caused anxiety among the pro-neocolonial forces inside Libya, which called upon the government forces to react to these latest developments. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal, we'd like to recap the main stories in the Pan-African Journal for this week. The widow of John Gurang, the founder of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and Army, Rebecca Nyack.